there, Dr. B here with your Module 2 clarifying lecture. Thank you for being patient with us. Again, we're still in that part of the term where we're still feeling our way around, getting settled, that type of thing. So I do appreciate your patience with that. Here in my office tonight, so a little bit of a different view. I'll also be reading from my screen, so you'll see me look up a couple of times. That's because I'll be reading from my big screen as opposed to my little laptop tonight. All right, so as usual, I'll start with general comments, talk about your inner teaching, then I'll talk about your discussions, and then I'll answer some of your questions. Okay, so first things first, you're going to hear me get really strict about things. I'm going to be saying things like you can't reinforce a person, or I'm going to say you can't say a reinforcer or a reinforcement, or I'm going to be really picky with language, and you're going to say, ugh. Okay, I say reinforce people all the time. I say it as an RBT. I say it at school. What is the big deal about it? Why do I care? So maybe it doesn't make that much of a big deal in the grand scheme of things, but I want you to think about this in terms of taking the test, which I forgot to say has a 65% pass rate. So it is very important that you're being very, very attention oriented when it comes to this stuff. But also that you're understanding these things really at a micro level. So think about reinforcing a person versus a behavior. If you think about that logic, first of all, you think of Phil Heinlein, right? If you reinforce a person, you're increasing the probability that that person's going to occur in the future. Not real cool, right? You place a person on extinction, you're kind of extinguishing the person. That's not cool either. But think about it in terms of some of the criticisms of ABA that have happened over the years that, you know, we're trying to change people or we're trying to make them into something they're not. If you're reinforcing a person, you're trying to change a person. If you're reinforcing a behavior, you're changing a specific response. And that's a very different thing. So I want you to think about this in terms of, are you changing a person or are you changing the way they're responding to their environment? And that's why some of these terms are so very important to be thought about in a really strict way. The other reason why you want to think about this in a really strict way is because if you don't, you run the risk of using them inappropriately. And it's kind of like learning a new language. So when you learn a new language, you really have to use it very strictly, right? And then as you get more fluent with it, you can start to get a little bit more loose with it. You can start playing with the language a little bit. You can start experimenting, but you can always come back to the original, right? It's the same way with behaviorism. Remember, like I said last week, if you understand a technique, you understand technique. If you understand a concept, you know 1,000 techniques. Now, imagine if you get that concept wrong because you're defining it wrong. You now know 1,000 wrong techniques. So that's why I'm going to be really strict with things. The other thing is somebody asked me, why are the fluency quizzes so short? And we always get that question every semester. I pretty much expect that somebody's going to ask it, and it's a great question. Fluency is supposed to be something that is quick, consistent, and correct. So there's different levels of acquisition. So there's acquisition, and that's just getting it. So if you're in the acquisition phase, and let's say you're in the acquisition phase of positive reinforcement, you can define it. It might take you a while, but you can define it. If you're in the maintenance phase, you know, 30 days from now, I can say, what's positive reinforcement? And you can define it. If you're fluent, you can define it consistently, quickly, and correctly. why is that important if you're going to be working with these concepts? So think about it this way. These are the basics. This is the foundation. Reinforcement is pretty much the bedrock of behaviorism. So this is something that you're going to build everything else on top of. So if this part isn't fluent, when you get to the next piece and the next piece and the next piece and the next piece, those pieces are going to crumble. Like when you get to 623, if you're not fluent in those schedules of reinforcement, and I say, how are you going to fade the schedule of reinforcement to make sure that it's a more natural contingency, you're probably going to come back and go, oh, I'm not sure. What are you talking about? Oh, I think we went over that in 619. I'm going to have to go look that up. And oh my, and you don't want to be in that position. And you don't want to be that in that position when you come to your exam. So that's why we do fluency. And here's another example. Some people say, oh, you know, within 15 seconds is fluent. So I'm going to give you a little test, and I want you to come back and tell me how it goes. You can even post it to the discussion board if you want. So when you go to your favorite big box store, or it can be Nordstrom, or it can be wherever, and you're at the counter, and the person who brings you up, or even you can do self-checkout, this will work too, tells you what the total is, excuse me, stare at the machine for 15 seconds before you reach for your wallet. See what happens. Okay. See if the cashier or even the machine gives you a 15-second wait time. Even count how long of a wait time they're going to give you. They're probably only going to give you maybe 1 to 3 seconds of a wait time. If they're very patient, they might even give you up to 5. So our fluency drills are actually pretty generous giving a 15-second wait time between. Most fluency drills only do about a 1 to 3 second wait. So if you think about it, that's why fluency is so important. Another example of why fluency is so important is if you've ever had a child musician or you've been a child musician and you've ever gone to a grade school band concert where they're just learning how to play an instrument. Most of those kids are not fluent. So, you know, they're stumbling with their fingerings. Notes are coming out at random times. Sometimes you'll hear reeds squeak, that kind of stuff. They're usually pretty accurate, but they're not fluent. Compare and contrast that to a symphony orchestra, where the players are very fluent, so they get to do other things with the piece. So they get to start to play with phrasings, and they start to play with dynamics, and they get to play with, you know, different interpretations. That is why fluency is so important, and why we do our fluency drills. Somebody was asking about how they say the different font colors for the inner teaching are a little bit wonky, and why are we doing that? The reason is that it's to show that you're collaborating. If you don't want to do the different font colors and you would prefer to just, you know, write them in as one response, that's all right. I'm fine with that as long as you're showing some way that you're showing that you're collaborating. That's the big thing. So the big thing is that you don't want to have it so that, you know, one person takes one response, another person takes the next response, and you never talk to each other. The idea is that you're talking to each other to come up with the response. So if you want to do that and you just want to write it in, that's fine. As long as you're showing some sort of product to us that shows that you're collaborating, that's okay. I noticed that some of you have not submitted a link or a name for Milestone 2. So if you're wondering why you did not receive a grade for Milestone 2, that's probably why. We can't put a grade in, we can't override that unless you give us a name. So either type a name in, you gotta click on the link that says Milestone 2 within the assignments, or put a link into the Google Sheet. So either or is acceptable, but you have to put those things in for grading. I did update Fluency Quiz 2. There was a typo in there. So if you had issues with Fluency Quiz 2 and you had that specific question wrong because of the typo, I did give you credit for that. I think some of you are having issues with the behaviors biography because you're not accessing the template. Remember that that template is in Module 3 under Assignments. It's also available under the behaviorist biography. It gives you step-by-step instructions on how to do each of the milestones. So if you're not accessing that template, again, we're going to give you a 1. You're going to have to redo it. So make sure that you're going in and looking at that template and doing each of the milestones that way. So use that template because it's there to tell you what to do. All right, so let's talk a little bit about mentalism versus behaviorism, because I think some of you are struggling with this, and it's not an unusual thing to have happen. I'm going to be kind of peppering mentalism versus behaviorism throughout my talk here. Mentalism and behaviorism, we are bombarded with mentalism no matter where we go. I probably throw mentalism into these clarifying lectures all the time, even though I try to avoid them. Our whole kind of system, you know, our government is based on, you know, free will, right? Some people who are coming here may be psychologists that are basically, you know, that's pretty much your bread and butter is mentalism. So it can be hard to transfer into kind of a behaviorist paradigm. So I want you to consider what mentalism is versus behaviorism. So mentalism assumes that you have to have some sort of thought or internal cause before a behavior occurs. So it's a psychological thing. So it's a psychological trigger for something to occur. I have to be angry to, you know, to hit you, or I have to be frustrated to throw something at you. And in behaviorism, we say, not necessarily. And the reason that we say, not necessarily, is a couple of reasons. First is that there's a lot of patterns in things. And most of those patterns are not willful. They're not at the conscious level. So people say things like, oh, well, that's not going to work because he's not going to understand reinforcement. Reinforcement doesn't occur at the quote unquote conscious level. So any thoughts or feelings associated with consequences, whether they be reinforcing or punishing, because remember that consequences are not bad. Remember, there's no bad or good in behaviorism. It all happens independent of this consciousness. So thoughts and feelings are really kind of biological side effects. And those biological side effects may have some overt things that happen. So for example, you may have surges of hormones that happen in your body when a certain consequence is presented, let's say an aversive consequence, that ends up either being reinforcing or punishing. And as a result, tears form. And those tears have certain properties to them, and you end up crying or sobbing. And you've learned the word sadness to go with that. So when someone says, how are you feeling? And those same biological processes are happening, you might say, oh, I'm sad. But that doesn't necessarily mean that that caused something else to happen. Okay, do you see the difference between there? It's the same thing. So behaviorism sees thoughts and feelings as more biological processes. They're not psychological processes. They're side effects of all of these things that happen. So it's very similar to, you know, any other biological process. So you can't consciously secrete insulin to regulate your blood sugar. I mean, you wouldn't say someone with type 1 diabetes willfully stopped producing insulin in their pancreas, right? Well, you know, you just you didn't have enough willpower to produce insulin. I mean, that would be ridiculous, right? It just doesn't even make sense. It's the same thing with saying, well, they're attention seeking. Or, oh, they just want that. Wanting and seeking assume. You're making assumptions about what's going on in somebody's head. You can't confirm them. You can't deny them. Most of the time, when you say, why did you do that? And someone says, I don't know. That's actually true. We usually don't know why we do things. We usually don't know what our reinforcers are, most of the time. And it really takes somebody else to usually tell us what our reinforcers are. Because you can't want reinforcement. You can't seek it out. It's a process. Our reinforcers are our reinforcers. For good or for ill, they are what they are. So that's kind of, and we'll get to mentalism in a little bit, but that's basically what you want to kind of consider as you're going through this. All right, let's get into the inner teaching. I want to talk about each of the three questions that we were asked about. And I want you to keep in mind that these questions actually, there's some things that are changed to protect the innocent and the guilty, but a lot of these things do come from my practice and things that have happened within my practice over the last 25 years. So you might be like, oh, that's ridiculous, but these things do happen. Can't make them up. All right, so the M&M question. Here are some things to consider when you're thinking about the M&M question. What's the behavior? I reinforced him. You can't reinforce a person, so what's the behavior? We don't know. So that might be the first reason that the M&Ms didn't work, because if you're giving someone M&Ms and they're just sitting there, well, then actually, they keep sitting there. The M&Ms actually did work. Are the M&Ms even reinforcing? You're making an assumption that because they're M&Ms, that they're going to reinforce that particular response. Even if someone, quote unquote, likes M&Ms, if you do a preference assessment and they consume M&Ms, it's a good prediction that it might be a reinforcer, but if it doesn't change behavior, if it doesn't increase responding, it's not a reinforcer. Are you using these M&Ms correctly? If you're giving them a bunch of M&Ms and saying, do your worksheet, that's not how it works. That's not how any of this works. If you're not using them contingent upon a response, then that response is not going to occur again in the future. So there you go. And if behavior doesn't change, it's not a reinforcer. So it's not that reinforcement doesn't work. It's that whatever you're doing isn't working. So it's not that the process of reinforcement doesn't work. It's that you're not doing it correctly. So you as a behavior analyst need to go on a detective hunt and figure out which part of these things might be the issue. And that's kind of part of the fun, I think, is trying to figure that out and diagnose that issue and then provide some remediation. All right, this one is always interesting. The texting the ex one is really interesting because a lot of people want to insert mentalism because it's not necessarily an autism example. It's not necessarily a DD example. It's not a child example. It's an adult example. So it must not fit this, radical behaviorism paradigm. Yep, it does. We are all susceptible to the same reinforcers, punishers, operant paradigms as anybody else, whether you have a PhD, whether you are, Pope Francis, whether you are, Nancy Pelosi, it doesn't matter who you are. We are all, our behavior is all strengthened by reinforcement. So just something to think about. And I'm not trying to get political on that, but it's kind of like we're all humans, biological processes, reinforcement. So her behavior is most likely attention maintained by the ex. Ex texts back, maybe, if they do. It's probably attention maintained. It's not attention wanting. She's not wanting attention because we don't know that. Right? We don't know what she wants. Might not want attention, but the attention could be the reinforcer. She's not seeking attention because, again, we don't know what she's seeking, right? Can't know that. But we know that when she texts her ex at night, if the ex texts back, a fight ensues, texting increases, that text back is the reinforcer, plain and simple. So you have to be careful of, she misses her ex, there's a longing, there's toxic relationship, all that kind of stuff is just, it's kind of jargon. So you want to stay away from that part. There's three questions. What's the behavior? That's the first. So what's the response? What comes after the response? Is in a similar situation, if that what comes after the response is present, does the behavior happen again? If it does, that thing that came after the response is a reinforcer. That's it. Okay, so you got to distill it down. Okay, you can't overthink it. That's really the three questions. What's the behavior? What came after the response? And we'll be talking about the antecedent piece later. And will that person do it again in the future? Those are the three questions for right now. Now, could there be some antecedents like alcohol or going out at night? Yes, and we'll be talking about them later in the term. But for right now, let's focus on what comes after the response. So what about a fight? You know, she's fighting, she's crying. How can that be a positive reinforcer? Remember, no value judgments. There's nothing good, there's nothing bad. Think biology, think math. Positive means to add, negative means to take away. If the behavior increases, it's reinforcement. If the behavior decreases, it's punishment. Okay? So, math. You put something in, behavior goes up, positive reinforcement. Math. You take something away, behavior goes up, negative reinforcement. You put something in, behavior goes down, positive punishment. Take something away, behavior goes down, negative punishment. Okay, math, bio. Math, bio. Okay? So also the attention from friends could be a reinforcer. That could also be, oh, honey, yeah, he's such a jerk. Yeah, you're right. Oh, you gotta dump him. Yeah, oh, sweetie, let me give you a hug. Could also be the reinforcer as well. So the idea here is that the feelings are side effects. They're separate from the process, okay? They're not causing her to do anything. Okay, they're not causes, they're side effects. Okay, they're biological processes that we learn to talk about in a certain way. That's all they are. And if you do something over and over again, it's being reinforced. It doesn't matter if you're happy or you're miserable. You can be miserable during positive reinforcement. That's what this was supposed to show, okay? So there was a question during inner teaching about, are reinforcers of people with disabilities somehow qualitatively different from the reinforcers of people with quote-unquote typical development? And the answer is no, they're not. They're not. Everybody's reinforcers and punishers are different. Every single person on the earth has different reinforcers, different punishers. So to say that, you know, oh, well, they have autism, so their reinforcers are going to be different. They're going to look different. They have to be this way. That's not true. That's not it. there may be some specific preferences that tend to cluster around people who have a diagnosis of autism, but that doesn't mean everybody with autism likes trains. That's a myth, okay? So you gotta get away from the myth and really look at the person and understand the person's contingencies and the person's reinforcers, and then understand that those reinforcers are used to increase and decrease responses, not to change people. And that's why we're strict. That's why it's so important. Okay, so let's talk about the TV program. And that was really to look at this idea of positive reinforcement, negative reinforcement, and also look at the idea that, oh boy, as a society, we get this stuff like this reinforcement punishment stuff way wrong, right? So the first things first, reinforcement always, 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 always strengthens a response. You can't conflate reward and reinforcer. Okay, we're going to get super strict on this. We're going to start taking off a lot of points for it because a reward is something nice you give to somebody, but it has no effect on what you do the next time that situation presents itself again. Okay, a reinforcer starts a pattern of responding. So when you're in that situation again, you're going to do the same thing again. That's the difference between a reward and a reinforcer. So remember, positive isn't good, negative isn't bad. So sometimes I'll give this analogy of a table. So let's say you've gone to a flea market, and you found this really awesome table. It's going to be perfect in your living room, except it's a little wobbly. It's a lot wobbly, actually. It's really super wobbly. But it's gorgeous, right? So we can do a few things, right? We can paint it pink, but that doesn't make it less wobbly, right? That would be like a reward. It looks pretty. It's nice. Everybody will say, oh, look, you got a pretty pink table, but don't put anything on it because it's going to fall right off and going to get all messy. Or we could go to Home Depot, get some, you know, wood, maybe some 2x4s, you know, maybe some other stuff. We can turn the table over. Maybe we can even, you know, get some replacement legs for it. And, you know, it may not be pretty, but we can hammer some stuff in, you know, at the bottom of that table and maybe make it a little bit stronger. Maybe we can put something under one of the legs because it's too short and make it more even. And maybe that won't be the prettiest response, but it'll strengthen it. That's what a reinforcer does. A reinforcer strengthens. It doesn't have to be pretty. Okay? A reward is just something pretty. Okay? All right, let's get into the discussion board. Remember that even if you have only one video, you still have to post twice. So what can you do? You can answer your question and then respond to one other person in the group. So that's totally fine. You can respond to two other people in the group after you've responded to that question. Whatever you'd like to do is fine, but you do have to have those two responses. I do agree that Skinner is quite difficult to read. Quite frankly, he's kind of a lousy author. I don't think he's the greatest writer. As somebody in one of the sections said that sometimes people find audiobooks of Skinner to be a little bit easier than trying to read his prose. So I would recommend maybe trying, if you're really having a hard time reading Skinner, try an audiobook, because some people report that they have better luck listening to Skinner than trying to read him. Remember that reinforcement and punishment are processes, not things. I know that Skinner falls into this kind of like a reinforcement, a punishment, punishing people, reinforcing people. Remember that we've kind of moved beyond that. So remember that reinforcement and punishment are processes, please, I don't want to see the reinforcements, the punishments, a reinforcement, a punishment. I'd rather see reinforcers, punishers, reinforcing stimuli, but reinforcement is a process. So the other thing with Skinner is that, is it nature? Is it nurture? Yes, is the answer. It's both nature and nurture. But remember that everything is relative. So everyone is completely different. And your repertoire of behavior, my repertoire of behavior, has been created over time by a bunch of things. So it's been created by, you know, your genetic endowment. So, you know, you come to this earth with a set of genetics, and like my genetics have given me, well, it used to be blonde hair, now it's super gray, and blue eyes, hypermobile joints, and I'm 5'5". Yeah, so chances of me ever playing NBA basketball are pretty slim. You've got your history. So where did you grow up? What was your reinforcement history? What does your community look like? What, how did the community reinforce and punish your behavior? What's your learning history look like? All those types of things. What does your family history look like? We're learning more about epigenetics. So, you know, what are the types of things that, you know, your parents learned or your grandparents learned? How are they passed along from generation to generation? And how did they influence your learning? And no two people are alike. So, you know, two twins could grow up in a house together and have completely different learning histories. And that can be due to a lot of different things. That can be due to, again, our biology, our genetics, our, you know, you can sit in a room and have, you know, two different experiences in the same exact room. So you're not born with a set personality. You're not born with a set way of being. You're not, it's not like, oh, you know, this is, you know, predetermined for you and your life's going to be this way. It's really more of that everything is relative to your experiences and your genetics and your history. And that's what creates you and the repertoire of your behavior. So you're a product of your experiences, you're a product of your environment, you're a product of your genetics. And no two people have the same experiences, genetics, etc. Somebody asked if delayed gratification is a synonym for delayed consequences, and the answer is no. Because remember that gratification is an explanatory fiction, it's mentalistic. It assumes that consequences and reinforcers are somehow it somehow makes people happy or something like that. And remember that, you know, reinforcement can make people, reinforcement can make people miserable. So, you know, you can have delayed reinforcement that is awful, right? So no, they're not necessarily the same thing. How does Skinner talk about intrinsic versus extrinsic motivation? First of all, we don't separate the two. And the reason is because you'll see that there's a continuum of reinforcement, that it's not like intrinsic versus extrinsic. That's kind of more for the cognitivists. What we say is that reinforcement comes from different places. So reinforcement can be automatic, which means that it comes from some sort of biological process. But most likely what we see as quote unquote intrinsic reinforcement is usually some sort of reinforcement that has been thinned to the point where it's almost indistinguishable what the contingency is. And I'll give you an example from my own life. So, you know, I've been in a lot of hobbies and I've done a lot of different types of hobbies, and I've done them in different places and have lived in a lot of different places. And it can look like, you know, when you're in a hobby and you're doing it and you're doing it like 7 days a week, it looks like you're intrinsically motivated, you know, like it's like, you know, I have a drive to do it, right? And then you move somewhere else and it's like, oh man, you know, I gotta adjust to this and I gotta make new friends and, you know, the vibe's not exactly the same and I'm dropping down to 5 days a week and it's 3 days a week. And then, you know, I start to make new friends and I start to, you know, build up a little bit more and then I'm going a little bit more and then I drop down, then I drop back up. So all of a sudden you realize maybe it's not so much that that intrinsic motivation. Maybe there was some sort of environmental contingency that was going on that just wasn't apparent. It wasn't distinguishable. Or, you know, there's something on the outside that's going on that is a reinforcer. So let's say, oh, you know, I love to bike ride and I'm intrinsically motivated to bike ride. Oh, you are, you know, when do you bike ride? Oh, I always bike ride in the fall because I love to look at the leaves. That doesn't sound like intrinsic motivation to me. That sounds like looking at the leaves is a reinforcer for bike riding. So that's how we look at it. We look at it as there's some sort of reinforcer that's indistinguishable, or it's on a schedule that's so thin that it's hard to notice. And that's why people are like, oh, it's intrinsic. So I think I've kind of beaten the feelings are more side effects than causal variables. And why, you know, I just said realized and I probably shouldn't have. That's probably an error. Well, it is an error on my part. Why don't we say things like, oh, the kid realized that things had changed, or, and I say that's mentalistic. Why shouldn't I have said that? Because it implies a mental shift. It implies that there's some sort of mental thing going on that says, the contingencies are different. Most of the time, if we're doing that realization, it's way after the contingencies have shifted and our behavior has shifted, which kind of implies, again, that this mental stuff, that these feelings, excuse me, are actually side effects of reinforcement. So something to think about. Now, when we talk about Johnston for a minute, let's talk about the idea of responsibility. It really kind of sounds like with Johnston, one of the things that's complicated in behaviorism is that it sounds like we are saying, well, then you can't blame anybody for anything because it's just the contingencies. If somebody murders somebody, I mean, it's not like you can say, oh, you should take responsibility for your actions because, you know, it's just a reinforcer. It was reinforcing to murder somebody, right? That part is kind of complicated. And Johnston will start talking about that a little bit later in his chapter. So stay tuned as to what he's going to say about that. I also want to talk about a little bit about the difference between predestination and determinism, because sometimes people get these confused. Predestination is more of like a theological idea, and it has to do with, you know, are you determined to go to heaven and hell? And when you're born, you know, is it like, okay, well, you're already predetermined as to where you're going to go. You're going to go to heaven. That's not what determinism is. Determinism says that the things that happen in your environment determine what you're going to do. It doesn't mean that things can't change. You can change behavior by changing contingencies, by changing the environment. They're not predetermined. So be careful of the predetermined versus determined. And I want to talk a little bit about explanatory fictions. What's an explanatory fiction? How is it different than mentalism? Well, mentalism is a form of explanatory fiction. So an explanatory fiction is really a circular reasoning. And I'll give an example. So one of you was talking about, well, they got frustrated, then they threw the car. So why is that not causal? It's a great question. Because we don't know that they were frustrated. So we say that they're frustrated. Then they threw the car. Well, how do you know they were frustrated? Well, they threw the car. And you can see where that's going to go and go and go and go. The only way to prove that this person was frustrated would be to actually go into their head and look at things from their actual perspective. So I call it the Ms. Frizzle test. If any of you remember the Magic School Bus and Ms. Frizzle, Ms. Frizzle drove the Magic School Bus. It was a cartoon for kids, science thing. And Ms. Frizzle could make the Magic School Bus shrink down. And if she was talking about biology, she could make the Magic School Bus go into the body and do all kinds of stuff within the body. So imagine, so if you need to have Ms. Frizzle drive the Magic School Bus into somebody's brain in order to observe that particular behavior, whether it be a thought or a feeling, in order to confirm it, it's mentalism, and if you're using it to explain a behavior, it's an explanatory fiction. Okay, so if it doesn't pass the Ms. Frizzle test, then it's an explanatory fiction. It's mentalism. So always think Ms. Frizzle. All right, almost done. Let's get to some questions. What caused the myth that there are different learning styles? What's the difference between learning styles and learning channels? All right, so learning styles came up, I think, in the mid-1980s. I don't know what caused the myth, per se. I do know that, you know, it's been around for a while. But there's been a lot of, you know, research that says that we don't have a particular learning style. So people are not necessarily visual learners or auditory learners. There's a big myth that people with autism are visual learners. So that's why we do lots of visual stuff. And that's pretty much been debunked. There's lots of literature on that you can find. And the truth is that it depends on the task. So, you know, for some things we do things hands-on, and that's kinesthetic. For other things we watch. For other things we listen. And that's where learning channels come in. And that's, for this task, what sensory channel do we use to input the information, and what sensory channel do we use to output the information? So, for example, if I'm doing a reading comprehension, the learning channel would be see the word, say the word. Learning channel would be see, say. If I'm doing a listening comprehension, it would be hear, say. And if it was kinesthetic, it would probably be, if I was saying touch, or let's say touch the picture that goes with blue. That would be hear, touch. So those are the learning channels. That's the difference. So it's, you know, what are the things that are needed to actually get the response going? What is the main difference between the perceiver and the receiver in Skinner Chapter 5? There really isn't one. I think he's more kind of, he does a lot of comparing and contrasting to the kind of common philosophies of the day. Like he'll talk about Erikson, he'll talk about Freud, he'll talk about that kind of stuff. And I think that's what he's kind of doing there. So there really isn't a difference between perceiver and receiver. He's doing more of a comparison contrasting. When submitting a wiki, does it have to be APA format double space? No. Mm-mm. No, but if you do use some sort of outside source, please use a reference as close to APA style as you can. How often does a behavior need to be reinforced before that behavior can be generalized? There is no specific formula. This is one of those, it depends. It just depends. I wish I could say 75 times. And I'm sure you've heard that one thing that it takes, you know, 10,000 trials to learn or something like that. And the honest answer is that it depends. It depends on the response. It depends on the learner. It depends on their history. It depends on their genetics. It depends on their past, you know, experience. It depends on all kinds of stuff, all those things that I talked about earlier on in the clarifying lecture are all going to influence how they're going to respond to what you're doing right now. So there really is no real, there's no real way to substitute for, you know, getting to know your child that you're working with or your adult or whoever you're working with, because I'm going to start using ABA with health coaching. So I can't say that I'm going to work with kids. I'm going to be working with adults. But you got to know history. You got to know learning. You got to know, you know, their genetic history, that type of thing. Otherwise, you got to take data. Your data will be your guide, as Joe Lally used to say to us. In God we trust, everyone else must have data. All right, this one's a long one, but hopefully you're getting a lot out of it. So thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.